burned to apply them. Like many cavers, they had experience with technical diving and breathing trimix, and were eager to discuss theory and ideas. When the Rouses hit water, it was clear they were blood. They dove as a team and had developed a sixth sense between them, the kind of anticipation born of a lifetime of living under the same roof. Underwater, they remained absolutely loyal, each willing to sacrifice himself for the good of the other. This single-mindedness, this love, made the Rouses perhaps the most formidable team in diving. When Nagel invited the Rouses to join the Yoo-Hoo expedition, Chrissy vowed to solve the mystery. He told Chatterton that by identifying the wreck, he would immortalize the Rouse name and contribute a page of history to the world. His father did not bicker with him about this. "They're more than talented and capable enough to do it," Chatterton told Kohler. "They may be the ones who get this done." The weather for the June trip was not nearly as perfect as it had been in May, but the divers' plans remained the same. Chatterton would search the forward torpedo tubes for numbered tags. Kohler would hunt for identifying artifacts. Crowell would measure the wreck. Jurga would determine if the Yoo-Hoo had been built with a deck gun. As for the Rouses, they would penetrate the wreck and begin to learn the U-boat. As before, Chatterton and Kohler dove together and set the hook. This time, Kohler swam forward with Chatterton, his eyes scanning the areas where crewmen kept records and personal belongings. Chatterton moved through the forward section of the U-boat, into the torpedo room, and up against the torpedo tube hatches. Where he had once seen nothing in this spot, he now saw a white, tag-shaped patch of encrustation on the hatch. He grabbed his knife and pried the blade under the encrustation. White flakes fell away, revealing the perfect outline of a tag. Except no tag remained. Corrosion had eaten away the metal so that only the imprint of the tag had survived. Chatterton's heart sank. He inspected the other three torpedo tube hatches. Same story. A half-century of salt water and storms had gnawed away the answer. As Chatterton turned to end his dive, he felt profoundly disappointed. He had developed concrete evidence for the tag's existence and had designed a well-researched plan for their retrieval, only to find them eaten by nature. Just behind Chatterton, Kohler was having better luck. While in the non-commissioned officer's quarters, he discovered a closet full of boots and shoes, still lined up neatly, left, right, just as the crewman had left them. He took one of the boots, believing a crewman might have written his name inside. "It doesn't look like you guys were wearing these, so I'm going to take one," he explained to the room full of remains around him. Kohler moved next to the conning tower, lying broken in the sand beside the U-boat. Inside, he discovered a bicycle-type seat. At once he recognized the piece as the chair on which the commander sat while manning the attack periscope. "This might be where the commander died," he told himself. "If this U-boat was attacking when it was sunk, this is where the guy would have been sitting." The chair, however, bore no identifying marks, so Kohler left it alone. He met Chatterton on the anchor line. Each man shook his head. Neither had solved the mystery. While Chatterton and Kohler decompressed, Crowell and Jurga set about their missions. To measure the wreck, Crowell attached one end of a surveyor's tape measure to the U-boat's bow, then swam aft, allowing the tape to unspool from its reel as he moved. He had affixed a tag to the tape at the 250-foot mark before leaving on this trip, the length of the typical Type 9. If this U-boat was any longer than that, it would be powerful evidence that the wreck was U-851, the rare Type 9D U-cruiser commanded by Merton's rebel colleague, Weingartner. Crowell allowed the line to unspool slowly as he began his journey along the wreck's top. Line spun free of the reel. As the tip of the U-boat came into view, the reel hiccuped. Crowell looked down. His marker had come up. The wreck was about 250 feet long. U cruisers were 287 feet long. This could not be U-851. While Crowell prepared to ascend, Yerga settled in just forward of the damaged control room area. He had made a careful study of Type 9 deck plans and knew exactly where to look for the deck gun mount, a known feature of U-158, the submarine commanded by the daring Irvin Roston. Yerga crab-walked along the top of the wreck and envisioned the blueprints he had devoured like pulp fiction novels during the off-season. He surveyed the relevant area. The evidence was plain as day. This U-boat had been built without a deck gun mount. This wreck could not be U-158. In the course of 20 minutes, the divers' two leading theories had been sunk. The men regrouped topside. Each seemed more shell-shocked than the next. A winter of intense research had come to naught. None of them could fathom any viable contenders other than the two they had just eliminated. They half-heartedly inspected the inside of the boot Kohler had recovered. As befitting the day, it contained no information. The Rouses surfaced soon after. Neither father nor son had found much of significance. Chatterton and Kohler made another dive, but found little. As the boat headed back to Brielle, the divers knew that summer was upon them, meaning that Nagel would begin running the Seeker to the Andrea Doria, his money trips. None of them knew when the boat might again be available to take them to the Yoo-Hoo. The day after returning from the Yoo-Hoo, Chatterton wrote a letter to Carl Friedrich Merton. He explained that divers had measured the wreck and determined that it could not be U-851, the boat Merton believed his colleague Weingartner had commandeered to New York. Merton wrote back expressing gratitude for Chatterton's efforts and acceptance of his conclusion. Chatterton did not phone Major Gregory Weidenfeld of the Civil Air Patrol. Though the divers had ruled out U-158, they still allowed that the wreck might have fallen to the CAP. For the next 3 months, Nagel ran to the Doria, and even when he had an open date for the Yoo-Hoo, the weather interfered. Chatterton still could not believe that the sub's torpedo tube hatch tags, which he had thought were made of resilient brass, had been eaten away. He tracked down an elderly U-boat veteran in South Carolina, who had also built U-boats in Germany's naval yards. The man explained that, as brass had become scarce, tags had been made of leftover materials, a metal stew that could not survive long in the marine environment. Chatterton thanked him for the information and began to say goodbye. "One other thing, if I might," the old U-boat man said. "Of course. What is it?" Chatterton asked. "Thank you for what you are doing. Thank you for caring about those boys down there. They don't have anyone else." Caring for the fallen crewmen had figured into much of Chatterton's and Kohler's thinking since the last Yoo-Hoo trip. Though neither spoke of it, a truth had begun pounding at their awareness. They would stand a far better chance of identifying the wreck by digging through the human remains. Many of the bones were still dressed in clothes, the pockets of which might contain wallets, coins, a personalized money clip, love letters, an engraved pocket watch, anything. Items like these survived for decades on shipwrecks. Frustrated and with no promising leads, Chatterton and Kohler fantasized about the answers that lay mixed among these bones. Chatterton called Kohler and set up a meeting at Scotty's Steakhouse, a popular nearby restaurant. "You want to talk about the men, right?" Kohler asked. "Right," Chatterton said. "It's time." The next evening, the divers sat down for ribeyes and baked potatoes. They discussed the prospect of digging through the crewmen's remains. The bones appeared to be well-preserved. Personal belongings were likely still among the bones. The only question was how to deal with those remains. Each man announced his decision. "I say we leave the remains undisturbed, no matter what," Kohler said.
"I agree," Chatterton said. "We don't touch them.
Even if it means we never solve the mystery."
For a moment the divers sat in silence, startled by the finality and similarity of their thinking. Slowly, each explained his reasoning until it became clear that they had arrived at their conclusions for identical reasons. Their discussion lasted for hours. Their resolve pivoted around five principles. 1. Respect for the crewmen. The U-boat men were sailors. They had risked their lives to serve their country. By doing that, they had earned a respect that entitled them to rest undisturbed. 2. Respect for the families in Germany. Neither diver could bring himself to tell a crewman's family that he had solved the mystery by rummaging through the pockets of their loved one's corpse. Nor were they willing to lie to a man's family and say that they had not done so, if in fact they had. 3. Honoring the Brotherhood of the Deep. As submariners, the U-boat men had embraced the risks of living below the ocean's surface. The divers existed in the same place, abided by the same laws, and faced many of the same perils, all of which generated a feeling of brotherhood and a sense of protectiveness toward the remains. 4. Protecting the image of wreck divers. The Yoo-hoo had become international news, Chatterton and Kohler emissaries of wreck diving. Their behavior would reflect on the sport for years. 5. Doing the right thing. The commitment to solve the mystery had originated in the instinct to do right by the crewmen. To violate their remains in order to find an answer would defeat the dedication to dignity with which the project had been undertaken. Chatterton and Kohler agreed on a simple guideline. If they saw a piece of identification lying behind, say, a skull, they could move that skull to retrieve the tag. But they would not search remains for evidence, even if they believed such a search would be productive. Moreover, they would create an environment of peer pressure to urge, even coerce, other divers to behave similarly. Driving home that night, Chatterton contemplated a final reason why he had determined to leave the remains undisturbed, a reason that seemed too personal to share with Kohler. More than ever, diving had become a reflection of life to Chatterton. The principles by which he had made himself a great diver were the same principles by which he lived. If he were to lower the bar now because he was frustrated, who would he be? Kohler, too, had kept a reason to himself. His German heritage, so much a part of his identity since childhood, had been reawakened in these brushes with the fallen crewmen. He never kidded himself about the U-boat's purpose or about the madman who had sent it. As an American, he would have attacked the U-boat himself had he been patrolling the Atlantic. But he also recognized these fallen men as Germans. These men, Kohler thought to himself, came from where I'm from. It took 3 months for the Seeker to set sail again for the Yoo-hoo. In September, the divers had to make the most of their opportunity. The weather would be unpredictable come fall, and this might be the last U-boat dive of the season. Optimism aboard the boat was muted this time around. Chatterton and Kohler had exhausted their leading theories and had whiffed in their hunt for an identifying artifact. Their disappointment, however, did not extend to the Rouses. From the moment father and son boarded the Seeker, they began their high-octane bickering, sniping at each other's equipment, sexual prowess, age, diving ability, sandwich choice, and, particularly odd to eavesdroppers, family ancestry. As before, Chris said little about what he hoped to accomplish on the U-boat. Chrissy was more forthcoming. "I'm going to identify the wreck," the junior Rouse told Chatterton. I'm going to be the one to do it.
As before, Chatterton and Kohler splashed together and tied in the anchor. This time, Chatterton swam toward the stern and dropped into the blown-out deck section that led to the aft torpedo room. His off-season research had revealed that this room contained an auxiliary steering station, possibly marked by a brass tag. But when he began to look around, he saw a boot, then a life jacket, then several skulls, femurs, and other remains, a boneyard before him. It was possible that the answer to the mystery lay within the remains. Chatterton turned and swam out. Kohler, in the meantime, had chosen to explore forward. As he entered the NCO's quarters, he spotted the cuff of a dark blue shirt that appeared to have spilled from a cabinet. Since it lay far from the human remains in the compartment, Kohler felt comfortable tugging at the shirt. Black silt billowed from the cuff. When the cloud cleared, he saw an arm bone in the sleeve. He let go of the shirt and apologized aloud, saying, "I'm so sorry, I had no idea." He replaced the shirt where he had found it and began to leave. A few feet later, as he neared the galley, he shined his flashlight under a piece of wood. The eye sockets from a skull stared back into his. Kohler's heart pounded. This was a bad day. He apologized again and made his way from the wreck. Chatterton and Kohler's second dive was equally unproductive. The Rouses, however, had better luck. In the galley, Chrissy had discovered a canvas-like fabric imprinted with German writing. "I don't know what the words mean," Chrissy told Chatterton and the other divers topside. "All I know is I gotta dig the thing out. It's stuck in there. But it looks important. I think I can get it on the next trip. This could be the thing." The Rouses, however, would have to hope that the weather held. Rough seas and violent storms could mess with anyone's project over the course of a long off-season. As Nagel fired the diesels and turned the Seeker back toward Brielle, every diver on the boat wished for just one more trip before winter. In early October 1992, Nagel booked the Seeker for the season's final journey to the Yoo-Hoo. It would be a 2-day venture, held over the Columbus Day weekend. The divers would have a final shot. The day before the trip, Nagel called Chatterton and begged out of the trip.
"I just don't feel like it," Nagel grunted.
"Bill, this could be the time. We need you," Chatterton said.
"Don't you get it?" Nagel exploded. "After I'm dead, nothing matters. Fuck the U-boat."
Chatterton tried to reassure his friend, but he had seen this transformation building all summer. Nagel had begun the season reflectively, taking comfort in the idea that even if he were unable to sober up and rebuild himself for diving, the Seeker's legacy would outlive him. Now, jaundiced and sicker than ever, a failure at countless rehabs, he could not bring himself to take his own boat to one of the biggest dives ever.
"You and Danny take the boat," Nagel said, ice clinking in the background. "I don't give a shit. Go without me."
On the night of October 10th, the divers gathered at the Seeker's Brielle dock. No one had to ask why Nagel was not in the wheelhouse. While the other divers tied down their gear, the Rouses began their bickering. This time their argument was a bit more serious than usual. Neither father nor son could afford Trimix for the trip. They would be forced to breathe air, a savings of a few $100. "Chrissy was supposed to buy the mix this time," Chris sniped.
"No, it was the old man's turn," Chrissy countered.
"Was not. Was too. Cheapskate. Miser." And so on into the evening. The next morning, Chatterton and Kohler splashed first, as had become their custom. While Kohler explored the NCO's quarters, Chatterton returned to the forward torpedo room in search of more tags. He found a few made of plastic, but none with identifying information.
On the way out, he spotted a bent piece of aluminum about the size of a tabloid newspaper lying amid a pile of wreckage. Ordinarily, he would have ignored such junk. This day, something urged him to pluck it from amid the garbage and drop it into his bag. Chatterton gave the artifact no more thought as he began his ascent to the Seeker. Topside, Chatterton emptied his bag. The aluminum piece, Swiss-cheesed by rust and splotched with marine growth, clanged onto the dressing table. Yerga walked over to inspect it. Chatterton opened the bent metal as if it were a magazine. Engraved on the inside were technical diagrams, a schematic illustrating the mechanical operations of some part of the U-boat. Chatterton grabbed a rag from a bucket of fresh water and wiped it across the artifact. The sea growth lifted easily, revealing small German inscriptions along the tattered bottom edge. Chatterton pulled the schematic toward his face. He read, Bauart 9C, and Deschimag Bremen. Hold everything, Jürger said. Deschimag Bremen was one of the German U-boat construction yards. That means this wreck was a Type 9C built at Deschimag Bremen. There couldn't have been more than a few dozen Type 9s built there during the entire war. This is huge for our research. Kohler surfaced a few minutes later. Like Jürge, he understood the magnitude of the discovery. This is really going to narrow things down, Kohler said, slapping Chatterton's back. All we have to do is go home, check our books, and we'll have the short list of 9Cs built at Deschimag. It's gorgeous. The divers splashed again that day, but found little. Their minds, in any case, were on Chatterton's spectacular find. That evening, over dinner, as the Seeker rocked in the waves while anchored to the U-boat, the Rouses admired the schematic and told Chatterton about their day. They had nearly excavated the piece of canvas covered in German printing, and believed they might be a dive away from bringing it topside. Optimism echoed off the salon walls. The divers wished one another a good night. In a single day, a season of dead ends had transformed itself. The Atlantic recused itself from the divers' optimism. As men slept aboard the Seeker, the ocean turned the vessel into a bathtub toy, tossing some divers from their bunks and forcing the captains, Crowell and Chatterton, to consult the weather radio. Conditions were snotty, with 5-foot waves, and the forecast had changed for the worse. At 6:30 a.m., Chatterton walked down to the salon and roused the divers. "It's getting nasty out there," Chatterton said. "Anyone thinking of diving best get going now. After that, we're pulling the hook and going home." "You diving, John?" someone asked. "Not on a day like this," Chatterton said. Of the 14 divers on the trip, just 6 moved from their bunks to gear up. Kohler was first and dressed without hesitation. A half hour later, he rolled into the ocean. The dive team of Tom Packer and Steve Gatto followed, as did New Jersey State Trooper Steve McDougal. The Rouses also rolled out of bed. "I'm not diving. Forget it," Chrissy said, peering out a cabin window. "Too rough out there." "You pussy!" his father bellowed. "You got no backbone, kid." "Didn't you hear, old man?" Chrissy asked. "Chatterton said the weather's nasty and getting worse. Can't you feel it out there?" "If you can't dive these conditions, you got no business being out here," Chris said. "I can't believe you're my son. You're an embarrassment." "Okay, you old crow," Chrissy said. "You want to go diving? We'll go diving. Let's go." For a moment, Chris said nothing. "Ah, that's okay," Chris finally said. "I was just jerking your chain. It really is too rough. Let's pass." "Too rough? Maybe too rough for you, you old geezer," Chrissy said, taking the offensive. "If you're too soft to go diving, I'll go myself. You stay here with the women." "You're not going without me," Chris said. "If you go, we both go."
"You guys are too much," Chatterton laughed, leaving the salon.
The Rouses continued bickering as they decided what to have for breakfast, whether to shave, how long their dive should last. Chris jokingly ordered Barb Lander, the only woman aboard, to fix his breakfast and wash his dishes. As the Rouses geared up, they reviewed their plan. Chrissy would return to the galley to free the piece of canvas containing the German writing. It was stuck beneath a floor-to-ceiling steel cabinet. Chris would wait outside the wreck, his lights a beacon for his son's exit. Chrissy would work for 20 minutes before exiting the wreck. At the dressing table, the Rouses affixed their trademark hockey-style helmets and started for the gunnels. Waves battered the Seeker's stern, knocking the flipper-footed Chrissy onto his side like an overtired toddler. Yerga forklifted him under the arms and stood him upright. Another wave rocked the boat. This time, Chrissy did a face-plant onto the deck. "Hey, Chris," Yerga yelled, "your kid keeps missing the ocean." Finally, Chrissy made it over the gunwale. His father followed, and their dive was underway. It took just a minute or two before the team hit the wreck and made their way from the anchor line to the opening gouged in the control room area. There, Chrissy unfastened the two small stage bottles he would breathe from on his ascent and laid them on the U-boat's deck. Next, he clipped one end of a nylon line to the torn-open entrance of the U-boat and slithered into the wreck, allowing the line to unspool from a reel attached to his harness. This way, even if the visibility dropped to zero, or he became lost or disoriented, he could follow the line out of the U-boat and back to his father. Cave divers like the Rouses called this technique running a line, and made it their religion. Wreck divers, however, did not believe in depending on nylon lines, or anything else, that could become tangled or cut inside a wreck's jagged guts. It took Chrissy just a minute or two to snake into the galley and begin his work. The pillowcase-sized piece of canvas he had worked on for so long still lay buried under the skeleton of a floor-to-ceiling cabinet made of heavy-gauge steel. Chrissy could not hope to move the massive cabinet. To free the artifact, he would have to dig beneath the cabinet into the rotting debris until enough space had been cleared to pull the canvas out. For perhaps 15 minutes, Chrissy burrowed with his hands, creating a silt tornado that blackened the room and dropped the visibility to zero. He kept digging and pulling. The canvas began to loosen from beneath the cabinet. Chrissy pulled harder. Mushroom clouds of silt exploded within the compartment. The jungle drums beat louder. He pulled again. More canvas came free, then even more, and it kept coming, like the scarves in a magician's trick, while the drums pounded louder and Chrissy grew closer to solving the mystery. Perhaps just seconds remained in the dive. Chrissy pulled again. The steel cabinet, now deprived of its bottom support, began to collapse, hurtling several hundred pounds of steel atop Chrissy's head and burying his face in the hole he had dug. Chrissy tried to move. Nothing happened. He was trapped. As the gravity of his situation sludged into Chrissy's consciousness, the feral dog, that is Narcosis, leaped from its cage and set upon him with full fangs baring. His head throbbed. His mind narrowed. He believed, more certainly than he knew his name, that a monster was on top of him, pinning him. He tried again to move, but could not. In its collapse, the cabinet had wedged between other debris and had become part of an interlocking sarcophagus atop the diver. Outside, Chris checked his watch and saw that his son was overdue. He had not planned to penetrate the U-boat. He was unfamiliar with the area in which Chrissy was working. He swam into the wreck. Chris reached his son and began working to free him from the trap. Chrissy struggled to climb out, but only burned faster through his remaining air and deepened his narcosis. Chris kept working. Finally, after several minutes, Chrissy came free of the cabinet. Father and son now needed to exit the wreck. Chrissy checked his watch. It read 30 minutes. He and his father were 10 minutes over on their time. Ordinarily, the Rouses would have followed Chrissy's nylon line out of the wreck and to the tanks they needed to breathe from to make their ascent. But in Chrissy's struggle to free himself, the line had become tangled around the canvas until it was a morass of knots. Narcosis banged like an industrial press inside Chrissy's brain, tunneling his peripheral vision and lighting the panic fuse of his instincts. He and his father swam in the direction of the control room and managed to exit the submarine through a crack between its skin and bulkhead. The tanks and the anchor line were now in front of the divers and just 40 feet away. All the Rouses had to do was swim aft, locate the bottles, and begin their ascent. In the struggle, however, Chrissy had likely become disoriented and believed himself to be facing the wrong direction. He turned around and swam toward the bow, directly away from the tanks and anchor line. His father followed. The Rouses searched frantically for their tanks. Chris, who had dropped only one of his stage bottles outside the wreck, gave the remaining one to Chrissy. A minute passed, and the Rouses kept searching. But they were now 150 feet from their stage bottles, and their narcosis was spiraling deeper by the second. 2 minutes passed, then three, then five. Still, they could not find their tanks. They searched for another 5 minutes, never knowing that they were turned around and nowhere near the stage bottles or anchor line. Chrissy checked his watch. He had been underwater for 40 minutes. The Rouses were now 20 minutes over their dive time. Their required decompression, originally 60 minutes, had now expanded to 2.5 hours. Neither had enough air to breathe for that long. A clear-thinking diver breathing Trimix likely would have used his remaining gas to eke out the best decompression possible. The Rouses, however, had made this trip without Trimix and were breathing air. Chrissy, terrified at losing his stage bottles and lost on the wreck, made a decision that divers spend a lifetime dreading: to bolt for the surface. His father shot up after him. Nagel had a saying about divers who rocketed to the surface after so long down deep. "They're already dead," he would say. "They just don't know it yet." The Rouses missiled toward the surface. At about 100 feet, they intersected a miracle. Somehow, in their explosive ascent, they spotted the anchor line, swam to it, and held on. Now they had a chance. They could fashion a decompression from their remaining air, then switch to the oxygen tank the Seeker dangled at 20 feet for emergencies. Chrissy switched from his main tanks to the stage bottle his father had given him. He sucked from the new tank and gagged. The mouthpiece had torn and was delivering water, not air. That was enough for Chrissy. He switched back to the main tanks on his back and bolted again for the surface. Again his father followed. This time Chrissy would stop for nothing. In the Seeker's wheelhouse, Chatterton, Kohler, and Crowell checked the weather and shivered. Brutal seas and nasty winds were rolling in. A minute later, they saw two divers pop to the surface about 100 feet in front of the boat. Chatterton looked closer. He saw the hockey-type helmets of the Rouses. They had come up an hour ahead of schedule. "Oh, Christ," Chatterton said, "this ain't good." Chatterton and Kohler tore down the wheelhouse steps and onto the Seeker's bow. Chatterton raised his arm and put his fingertips on his head, the universal "Are you okay?" signal to divers. Neither man responded. 6-foot waves threw the divers closer to the boat. Chatterton and Kohler looked into the men's faces. Both father and son had the wide, rapidly blinking eyes of the newly condemned. "Did you complete your decompression?" Chatterton yelled. Neither diver answered. "Swim to the boat!" Chatterton yelled. Chrissy moved his arms and inched closer to the Seeker. Chris also tried to swim, but he flopped sideways and half-kicked like a sick goldfish. "Chrissy, did you complete your decompression?" Chatterton pressed. "No!" Chrissy managed to yell back. "Did you come straight to the surface?" "Yes," Chrissy said.
Kohler went ashen at the answer. He remembered the Atlantic wreck diver's mantra. I would rather slit my throat than shoot to the surface without decompressing.
Chatterton grabbed two throw lines to fling to the Rouses. The Seeker rose and fell on the raging waves like a carnival ride, each undulation threatening to launch Chatterton and Kohler into the Atlantic. An 8-foot wave pushed Chrissy under the Seeker as her bow lifted off the ocean like an executioner's axe. The Seeker fell from the darkening sky, Chrissy helpless to move away. Chatterton and Kohler held their breath. The boat's splash rail hurtled downward and bashed the regulator on Chrissy's tanks, just inches from his skull, splitting the brass mechanism and releasing an explosion of rushing air from the tanks. Chatterton threw the lines. Each of the Rouses managed to grab a rope. Chatterton and Kohler pulled the divers along the side of the boat, towing them out from under the Seeker and toward the stern. Crowell ran into the wheelhouse. He radioed the Atlantic City Coast Guard repeatedly, but got no reply. Fuck this, he thought to himself. I'm calling a mayday. Mayday, 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 Crowell called into his handheld microphone. This is the vessel Seeker, requesting immediate helicopter evacuation. We have injured divers. Please acknowledge. The Brooklyn Coast Guard station responded. They were sending a chopper. Chatterton, Kohler, and other divers continued to tow the Rouses toward the back of the boat as the Seeker's bow rose and fell with thunderous booms. Chris came around nearest the ladder. Chatterton rushed toward him. "Chris, get up the ladder!" Chatterton yelled.
"Take Chrissy first," Chris grunted.
Chatterton began to insist, but stopped himself when he looked into Chris's widened eyes. In them he saw only fear and knowing. The kind of knowing that occurs when one's fate is certain and moments away.
"Okay, Chrissy, come up!" Chatterton yelled to the younger Rouse, who was holding onto a line about 10 feet behind his father. The divers pulled Chrissy to the ladder. He screamed in pain.
"I can't move my legs!" Chrissy yelled. "Monkey fuck! Monkey fuck! It hurts! It hurts so bad!"
Chatterton knew that serious decompression bends were already upon the divers. He and Kohler straddled the gunwale on either side of the ladder and put their arms under Chrissy, grabbing the underside of his tanks for leverage. The Seeker rose and fell with nature's onrushing tantrum, each explosion against the ocean threatening to catapult the divers overboard and crush Chrissy under the stern. The lactic acid in Chatterton's and Kohler's muscles burned as they willed themselves to hang on to the stricken young diver. Between impacts, they managed to lug Chrissy up the ladder until he thudded onto the deck like a netted tuna. "Get him onto the dressing table," Chatterton ordered. Kohler and others dragged Chrissy to the table and began cutting off his gear. Barb Lander, a nurse by profession, force-fed Chrissy aspirin and water and put an oxygen mask over his face.
"I fucked up! I fucked up! I fucked up!" Chrissy yelled. "I can't move my legs!"
Lander cradled his head. "You're okay, Chrissy," she said. "You're on the Seeker now." Chrissy thrashed and screamed and tried to tear the oxygen mask from his face.
"I can't breathe!" he screamed. "I'm burning! A monster pinned me! I was trapped!"
At the ladder, Chatterton turned his attention to Chris.
"Chris! Chris, come on, you're next! You can do it! Let's go!" Chatterton yelled.
Chris looked into Chatterton's eyes.
"I'm not going to make it," he said. "Tell Sue I'm sorry."
Chris's chin dropped to his chest, and his head flopped into the water. Chatterton and Kohler, both dressed in street clothes, leaped into the freezing ocean. Chatterton lunged for Chris's head and lifted it into the air.
"Get me a knife!" Chatterton yelled.
The Seeker bashed up and down in the Atlantic, hurling Chatterton and Kohler underwater. When the boat rose, Chatterton yelled,
"I gotta cut his rig off!"
Kohler pointed to a knife sheathed on Chris's shoulder. Chatterton grabbed it and slashed at the diver's harness until Chris's rig fell away. Chatterton then muscled Chris into a fireman's carry and brought him up the ladder, straining to hang on as the Seeker heaved and exploded into the ocean and sent salt water spraying into the men's eyes. Kohler looked inside Chris's mask,
praying to see more dread because dread would mean that Chris was still alive. Chris only stared straight ahead. The men dragged him onto the Seeker's deck, his fins sloshing along the sea-soaked wood. Chatterton began CPR on the Elder Rouse. For a few moments, Chris did not respond to Chatterton's efforts. His skin began to turn blue. Kohler murmured, "Come on, Chris, don't let go. Don't let go. Don't let go." Chatterton kept relentlessly at his CPR. Suddenly, Chris threw up into Chatterton's mouth, and Chatterton could taste the Pepsi he and Chris had shared that morning. Kohler sprang to his feet, hopeful that the vomiting indicated revival. Chatterton looked up at Kohler with eyes from 1970 Vietnam. "Richie, go in the wheelhouse," Chatterton said with a calm that seemed to Kohler to mute the raging ocean. "Get pencil and paper. Write down times and events. Be sure to get everything Barb's doing on that table and everything Chrissy is saying. Make sure she gets vital signs on him. Record everything. We'll need to send this information with the Coast Guard." Chatterton continued the CPR, but with each compression he felt increasing resistance, evidence that Chris's blood was turning to foam and clotting in his body. After 5 minutes, Chris's heart stopped, and his skin turned from blue to coal gray. The whites of his eyes were bloody. Chatterton knew he was dead. He kept pumping anyway. You did not give up on a human being just because he was dead. At the dressing table, Lander pushed Chrissy's long brown hair out of his face and held his head in her lap as he writhed and screamed and drifted in and out of lucidity. "The monster got me," he screamed. "A monster pinned me. Monkey fuck, it was a monkey fuck." Kohler bit his bottom lip and took notes. "My father, how is my father?" Chrissy asked. Kohler and Lander looked toward Chatterton as he pumped away on Chris's lifeless body. They knew Chris had died. "John's with your father," Kohler told him. "He's on oxygen. He's going to be fine. Hang in, Chrissy. Can you tell me what happened?" Chrissy went calm and for a moment spoke with a crystalline mind. He told Kohler that something had fallen and pinned him inside the wreck, that his father had come in and freed him, and that while they were ascending, he had run out of air. Then, just as quickly, Chrissy spiraled back into delirium. "I was in the wreck, and fuck this! I'm cold! I'm hot! I can't feel my legs!" Lander stroked his head. "Please shoot me!" Chrissy begged. "It hurts so bad! Someone find a gun and shoot me! Please kill me! Dad! Dad!" For the next 90 minutes, Chatterton and others continued CPR on Chris's dead body. Crowell, who had cut the anchor line, headed 30 degrees into the wind as instructed by the Coast Guard, then began a head count. Each diver called out, "Here." Crowell dropped the Seeker's antennas to allow the helicopter to approach unobstructed. He ordered everyone into life jackets, then demanded that any loose items be moved into the salon or secured to the deck. The helicopter's prop wash could turn a loose face mask into a deadly missile, or suck up a sleeping bag into its rotors and crash. On the horizon, the divers could see the orange and white Coast Guard chopper speeding toward them. All but Chatterton, Kohler, and Lander ran into the salon to stay out of its way. As the chopper lowered its shoulder and swooped toward the Seeker, the whine of its jet engines blanketed the sky, and its rotors made an upside-down rainstorm of the water still sloshing on the deck. The chopper settled to a hover just over the Seeker's bow and strained to hold its position in the roiling winds. From the side door, a muscular search and rescue swimmer dressed in a day-glow orange dry suit, gloves, hood, goggles, and fins, jumped feet first toward the ocean, one hand stretched across his stomach, the other holding his mask, a perfect dart into a violent sea. As he surfaced, he threw a medical bag onto the Seeker's deck and climbed aboard the boat. He made no introductions and offered no welcome gestures. Instead, he strode directly to Chatterton. "You're a little slow on those chest compressions," the swimmer said from behind rounded goggles. "It should be 1-2, 1-2. "I've been doing CPR on this guy for 90 minutes, Chatterton answered, still pushing into Chris's chest. He's dead. The swimmer pivoted and looked at Chrissy, who still had color in his face and was writhing in pain.
Okay, we're going to take both these guys, one at a time, the swimmer said.
Listen to me, Chatterton told the swimmer. I'm telling you this guy is dead. We need to take all our prayers and fucking hope and energy and throw it into that kid who's still alive. Forget the old man. If he were to sit up, he'd tell you the same thing.
That's not the way we do it, the swimmer said. We're taking both of them, one at a time.
Now Chatterton was in the Vietnamese jungle. Bullets flew past his ears and staccatoed the dirt. Long atrophied triage instincts flared to life.
Taking the old man will cost you 20 minutes, Chatterton said. Take the son and rush him to a recompression chamber as fast as possible. The time you waste with the father might cost the kid his life. I'm begging you, forget the father.
Not possible, the swimmer said. We take them both, one at a time. The swimmer radioed to the chopper to move in and drop the basket. A moment later, the metal stretcher was being lowered by cable toward the seeker.
No one touch anything, the swimmer yelled. This thing has a static charge that can blow you off your feet. Let the basket hit the boat's rail and discharge first.
The basket pendulumed in the howling winds before hitting a rail on the seeker and exploding with the discharge of static electricity. The swimmer ran to the basket, unclipped it, and waved the chopper away to ease the effects of its prop wash. The swimmer pulled the basket toward Chrissy, who was now bundled in a blanket, still screaming for his legs, still telling stories about monsters. He placed Chrissy inside and crossed his arms mummy-style. The helicopter dragged its cable through the water until it hit the boat. Chatterton, Kohler, and the swimmer lifted Chrissy's basket onto the gunwale and attached the cable. A moment later, the helicopter was heaving Chrissy into the sky.
"Look, I'm begging you," Chatterton told the swimmer. "Leave now. The kid's life depends on this. It's going to take 20 minutes to get that basket back down here to load up a guy who's already dead."
"Not possible," the swimmer said. Chatterton whirled toward Kohler. "Richie, take all the information you gathered, all the vital signs and notes and dive profiles, and put them in a waterproof bag. Then go into the salon and get the Rouse's wallets. It will be hectic and messy in there, but you will be able to find them if you stay with it. Put the wallets in the bag, too. Make certain that this swimmer leaves with that bag."
Kohler bolted for the salon. He tore through sleeping bags, dumped duffel bags, and overturned suitcases until he found both wallets, then rifled through the kitchen drawers until he found a Ziploc bag. Lander gave him the vital signs, notes, and dive profiles, and he packaged everything and made true the seal. As he opened the salon's door, he was blasted by seawater and winds from the chopper's blades. He pushed forward and pressed the bag into the swimmer's hands. Now the basket was coming down for Chris. Chatterton continued his chest compressions, muttering, "Son of a bitch, son of a bitch." In the jungle, he could have run to save Chrissy. He always ran. And even when the grunts shook their heads, he ran anyway, because it was the right thing to do, and because it had always been in him to run. Here, as the chopper sent a basket for a dead guy, while a live kid's blood foamed and choked his heart, Chatterton had nowhere to run, and that finality drowned him, because he had never in his life been unable to run. It took 20 minutes to load Chris onto the chopper. After both Rouses were aboard, the helicopter lowered the basket a final time for the swimmer. The jet engines screamed as the chopper swooped away and raced toward the recompression chamber at Jacoby Medical Center in the Bronx. One by one, the divers made their way from the salon and toward Chatterton. Each thanked him or hugged him. Everyone knew that Chris was dead. Everyone believed Chrissy would make it. The trip back to Brielle was somber but hopeful. Hospital recompression could take hours. The divers hoped to get word of Chrissy's condition by the next morning. The metal schematic, which had held so much promise and which had brought such optimism, lay forgotten, wrapped in a towel in a Tupperware container. That evening, Lander called Chatterton at home.
"Chrissy didn't make it," she said. "He died in the chamber."
Chatterton put down the receiver. In 36 years, there had been several thousand dives on the Andrea Doria,
the most dangerous of all shipwrecks. 6 people had died. In a single year, the Yoo-hoo had claimed 3 lives. Chatterton walked into his office. For months he had come here to gaze at the Horenberg knife and ask, "Who are you? What happened to you?" This time his eyes went through the knife. He sat for hours, not asking much of anything. Chapter 10 History Mauled. Shortly after the Rouses died, Chatterton and Kohler set out for the Yoo-hoo to retrieve the fallen diver's equipment. They had heard reports of Chrissy's recompression chamber experience at Jacoby. The bubbles in his system had turned his blood into sludge. Kohler smoked 30 cigarettes on the way to the wreck and wondered how long he could continue refusing the voodoo of Trimix in favor of air. Inside the wreck's galley, Chatterton shot footage of the fallen cabinet and shelves. The tangled penetration line Chrissy had relied on for navigation had been twisted around the 10-foot-long piece of canvas he had worked to excavate. In the now pristine visibility, Chatterton recognized this canvas as part of a life raft. Its German writing gave generic instructions for use. Outside the wreck, Kohler discovered the 3 stage bottles the divers had not been able to find in their confusion. Each was marked Rouse. None of them was inscribed with a first name. The tanks were interchangeable between father and son. At home, Chatterton and Kohler returned to the business of research. Now armed with the information from the schematic, they tore into their reference books in search of Type 9C U-boats built at Germany's Deschimag Bremen shipyard. 52 such U-boats, it turned out, had never returned from patrol. That list of 52, the divers agreed, could easily be narrowed. Over ribeyes at Scotty's, they agreed on 2 exclusionary parameters. 1. Eliminate any U-boat in which crewmen survived the sinking. If there were survivors, the U-boat's identity would be known and accurate in the historical record. 2. Eliminate any U-boat built with a deck gun. The divers had already determined that the Yoo-hoo had been built without a deck gun. Any Type 9 constructed at Deschimag Bremen with that weapon, therefore, could not be the Yoo-hoo. Chatterton and Kohler set out for Washington to begin the elimination process. Reference books indicated that there had been survivors on 22 of the 52 U-boats on their list. That left 30 U-boats to consider. Of these, 10 had been built with deck guns. The list was now down to 20 possible U-boats. "One of these U-boats on this single piece of notebook paper is our sub," Kohler said. "We are now looking at the answer," Chatterton said. "We just have to narrow this list down further." Neither man could remember having been so excited. This was original research. This was exploration. Back in New Jersey, the divers took their usual table at Scotty's and began to brainstorm. They needed additional exclusionary criteria to further narrow the list of 20. They quickly settled on a plan. They would return to the BDU KTBs, the German war diaries, to inspect where U-boat headquarters had ordered and plotted each of the remaining U-boats on their list. Any submarine the Germans believed to be operating more than a few hundred miles from the U.S. East Coast would be eliminated from the list of 20. After all, the Germans would know better than anyone where their U-boats were patrolling. The divers planned to return to Washington the next week. Chatterton would research half the boats, Kohler the other half. At midnight, the night before the trip, Kohler's phone rang. The caller did not speak. The only evidence of another person on the other end was the sound of ice clinking in a glass. That sound meant the caller was Nagel.
"Hey, Richie, it's me," Nagel said. "Think we'll ever figure out this U-boat?"
"Sure, Billy, we will," Kohler said. "What's going on? It's midnight."
"Ah, I'm sitting here alone, just thinking about the U-boat. You know, Richie, sometimes I just want to end it all."
"What are you talking about, Bill?"
"This is bullshit, Richie. I got my gun right here. I should blow my fucking head off right now.
Whoa, Bill, hold on. You got everything in the world, man. You got a boat, a beautiful family back in Pennsylvania, money, a nice house. All you gotta do is run a boat. That's a nice life. I'll take that life.
Ah, you ain't got no clue, Nagel exploded. Feldman's dead. The Rouses are dead. My old friend John Dudas is dead. I see all these dead guys in my dreams, Richie. I gotta go.
Nagel hung up. Kohler's fingers pounded out Chatterton's phone number.
John, it's Richie. Bill's gonna kill himself.
He does this sometimes, Chatterton said, still groggy. He's in a terrible way. I've tried to intervene. His family has intervened, his girlfriend, too. I've taken him to rehabs. You know what he does? He takes a few weeks off. He gets himself just well enough to enjoy drinking again, checks himself out, then stops at the liquor store on the way home. I don't think he'll kill himself, at least not with a gun. I think Jim Beam's the weapon of choice.
Can we do anything? Kohler asked.
We've all been trying for years, Chatterton said. I don't know what else anyone can do.
The divers returned to Washington and attacked the U-boat control diaries. According to the German records, 18 of the 20 U-boats on the divers' list had been operating in or ordered to areas so distant from New Jersey as to be unworthy of further consideration. That left two U-boats, U-857 and U-879. According to the diaries, each of these submarines had been ordered to attack targets of opportunity on the American East Coast. As the divers read further, they came upon a bombshell. Both of these submarines had been docked in Norway in early 1945, the same place and roughly the same date as Horenberg's boat, U-869.
That could explain the knife, Kohler said.
Exactly, Chatterton said.
Maybe Horenberg lent the knife to a guy on the U-boat next to his. Maybe he lost it and it ended up on a nearby boat. Maybe someone stole it. Any way you look at it, the knife now makes sense.
One of these two submarines has got to be the U-Who. It's either U-857 or U-879. We're down to two U-boats.
The divers rushed to their history books. According to these texts, U-857 had been sunk off Boston by the USS Gustafson, while U-879 had been destroyed off Cape Hatteras, North Carolina, by the USS Buckley and USS Reuben James. That seemed to leave no chance that the mystery wreck was either U-857 or U-879.
"Let's do this," Chatterton said. "Let's check the files for the sinkings of these two subs. Let's see for ourselves what the Navy says about how these two U-boats were killed."
"Are you saying these two U-boats might not have been sunk where the history books say they were?" Kohler asked.
"I'm saying we have to check," Chatterton said. "I'm getting the feeling we have to check everything."
It was evening by now, so the divers packed their gear and found a $35 motel room on the city's outskirts. The next morning they returned to the NHC, drooling to get at the Navy files for their remaining two U-boats, one of which had to be the answer to their mystery. The divers looked first at Navy files for the sinking of the U-857 off Boston, which gave this account. While patrolling Cape Cod on April 5, 1945, U-857 fired a torpedo at the American tanker Atlantic States, wounding but not sinking her. American warships were dispatched to the area to hunt and kill U-857. 2 days later, one of those warships, the destroyer USS Gustafson, obtained a sonar contact on an underwater object near Boston. It fired several hedgehog bombs into the ocean toward the contact. Crewmen reported hearing an explosion shortly thereafter, and then smelling oil. And that was it. No evidence of a U-boat had floated to the surface. No blobs of oil had been spotted on the surface. The divers could not believe what they read next. Navy assessors who analyzed the Gustafson's attack had written the following conclusion. It is considered that, although a submarine, known to have been in this area, may have been lost, it was not lost as a result of this attack. It is therefore recommended